Yep. Sorry, I just got a message. Okay, cool. So in this case, we can think of this now as a gravitational atom. So the system that builds up now is a black hole and a cloud of bosons around it. Similarly, this is similar to the classical atom, where you have the nucleus with the cloud of electrons around it. And similarly to the classical atom, the particles, the bosons here, can occupy energy states or energy levels with well-defined properties. And where in the case of the classical atom, these energy states depend on this alpha parameter that has to do with the electric charges of the nucleus and the electron. With the gravitational atom here, with the black hole and the bosons, these properties are defined by this, again, what we call alpha. We're calling this alpha, that has to do with, as proportional to the mass of the boson and the mass of the black hole. So this combination of boson black hole mass gives you this parameter that defines, for the most part, the properties of the system. And yeah, so in this case, there are multiple levels that can be populated. And in this case, I'm just going to be focusing on the fastest growing level. So this is the lowest energy level, basically. When you have so many particles, 10 to the 78 bosons, occupying the same state in a small space around a black hole, what you can get then is two bosons annihilating into, let's say, a graviton in the presence of the black hole's strong gravitational field or gravitational potential. So if you just have two bosons annihilating into a graviton, then your gravitational wave frequency, or the frequency of this graviton, is going to be proportional to just approximately just twice the mass of the boson. Because you have so many particles, of course, you have many sets of boson annihilations happening at the same time. And so you can look at this instead as a gravitational wave. And because they're all in the same state, then because they're bosons, then you get coherent gravitational wave emission. So you get coherent gravitational wave emission at a frequency that's just twice the mass of the boson. And there's so this should occur then around any black hole that exists, but it's not quite true, because there is because in order to really maximize the rate of the cloud's growth, you need to have a black hole mass that's, or black hole radius that's approximately the same size or order of magnitude size-wise as the boson wavelength. And so if you have a black hole and a boson that are approximately similar sizes, then this is when you really start to maximize the rates of the cloud levels growing and then producing gravitational waves. So the types of, so when we talk about gravitational waves, so far we've been talking of, so far the gravitational waves we've been detecting have been transient signals. Excuse me. So these are signals that come from the mergers of two compact objects, so black holes, neutron stars. And so far, these have been signals with gravitational wave strains. So this is the fractional change in length as the gravitational wave passes through. So these have strains of around less than 10 to the negative 21. So this is the, again, the fractional change in length. And this strain, how loud the signal is, basically, depends on properties like, of course, like how close the system is to you, and also how massive the objects are. And the frequency of these signals changes. It depends on what point the orbits, or what point in the spiral in phase the objects are. So the objects, when they're farther apart, of course, the orbit takes longer, and so the frequency is lower. And then as they get closer together, then the frequency increases. And in theory, then this is, so we know we can come up with the waveforms for what these signals should look like. Of course, in reality, there's also detector noise that will change what we actually observe a little bit. And this is what you're seeing on the right. So this is from the first detection of gravitational waves. So this is from GW150914. And what you're seeing in all of these is, or in the top two plots, for instance, there's the smooth line, that's the predicted waveform, and then there's the jagged line above it. That's the actual measured signal. So there's always going to be a little bit of difference, of course, from the ideal case. But in general, for these transient signals, especially if they're loud enough, you can sort of pick out by eye, if they're loud enough, the signals in the data. But when we have transient signals, we should also have continuous signals. This is true about astronomy in general, right? In general, you have objects that are emitting some sort of radiation, or in this case, gravitational waves, that are always there, that are persisting. And so continuous signals should also exist, or continuous gravitational waves should also exist for gravitational waves. The canonical sources, let's say, of continuous gravitational waves have been considered to be, for instance, neutron stars with some sort of asymmetry, some sort of non-axisymmetric asymmetry. So this could be thought of as a toy model, as a neutron star with some sort of bump or mountain on it, because there were some structural differences that haven't smoothed out over time, or maybe because it's accreting from a companion. Or this could also be mass currents moving inside a neutron star, for instance. In any case, what you end up getting is a signal that has a very well-defined frequency, because it really just depends on the neutron star rotation. And so this should last for a long time. Neutron stars are spinning for a long time. And it should be fairly stable, because neutron stars, for the most part, spin fairly stably. They will start to slow down, of course, but overall, they're fairly stable. However, these signals are many orders of magnitude weaker than the transient signals that have currently been detected. So while you could say the transient signals, for instance, have so far been had strains of less than 10 to the 21 or so, continuous signals, roughly speaking, hand-wavingly, continuous gravitational waves are expected to have strains of less than around 10 to the negative 25 and possibly orders of magnitude less. This really depends on how large, for instance, the mountains on neutron stars actually are. So brief pause to talk about gravitational wave interferometers. So gravitational wave interferometers have worked by a sort of relatively simple, very elegant method. So what happens is you have a beam that passes through and passes through a beam splitter, so which splits the beam in half, and each half that passes down a leg or an arm passes down an arm of the interferometer and comes back, and then the two beams that come back then are interfering with each other again, and depending on when the lengths of the paths that the two beams take, then you could have different interference patterns. And of course, the arms will change length slightly when you have a passing gravitational wave. And by seeing how the interference pattern changes, then you can work backwards and figure out the properties of the gravitational wave that passed through, or at least, for instance, the strain, the fractional length change in length caused by this gravitational wave passing through. So this cartoon picture, of course, of gravitational wave interferometers is all well and good. In reality, it's a bit more complicated than this. So what you're seeing here on the right are pictures of the four current generation gravitational wave interferometers, or four of the main four current generation gravitational wave interferometers. At the top, you have LIGO Hanford and LIGO Livingston in the US. Bottom left, you have Virgo in Italy. And then bottom right, you have Kagra in Japan. So they operate with the same type of overall structure that I showed before in the cartoon picture, but they all have their own sort of advantages and their own difficulties or complications that they have to deal with. So what you're seeing on the left here is a plot that kind of shows you the strain noise, or you can think of as the detector sensitivity over frequency. So these gravitational wave interferometers are sensitive to frequencies between around 10 hertz and a couple thousand hertz. The sensitivity in this range of these interferometers, of course, is not going to be flat. It's going to depend on many things. Some of these things are, for instance, you can see that there's, for all of these shapes, all of these sensitivity curves, there's a overall broad shape, and this can be affected by things like the shot noise of, the noise, the shot noise that's caused when your laser hits your mirror and it up slightly or causes some sort of motion in the mirror. There are also, of course, different, you can see these vertical lines here. So there are also sources of noise that only appear at certain frequencies. These are very hard to tamp down on because these are very complex systems and you might have some resonances, mechanical or electrical, that you didn't realize you had in these complex systems. But some interesting sources of noise, for instance, are the power mains. So 50 hertz, 60 hertz, these are hard to get rid of. You also can have some sources of noise due to, for instance, resonances in parts of the suspension system, because you're going to have some resonances there depending on the properties and the length of the things that are used to suspend some of the objects. So one thing to notice here is that the curves, the sensitivity curve on the left here, they go from around 10 to the negative 23, 10 to negative 22 or so at the most sensitive, let's say. Whereas what I just talked about, the continuous gravitational waves have strains, expected to have strains of less than around 10 to the negative 25. What this means is that you really, in order to search for continuous gravitational waves, you really have to dig into the noise. This works out okay with continuous gravitational waves because they're expected to be long lasting and at very particular frequencies. So you're able to do that. You're able to take data over a long time and to really combine all of that data together to try to search for a signal, because the noise will cancel out, but the data, but the signal should remain or should get stronger. So in theory, this should be pretty straightforward because the wave at the source is just a sinusoid. If we're talking here again about the neutron star with the bump on it. So if you have a waveform that's just a sinusoid, then if you just take a Fourier transform and you know the frequency and maybe you know the frequency derivatives or how the frequency is changing, then you should be able to get one well-defined peak in frequency. This is where all the power should be. Of course, in reality, it's a bit more complicated than that. This is because the Earth is not stationary with respect to the gravitational wave sources. So the Earth, of course, is rotating around its axis and also orbiting around the Sun. So this rotation in orbit will cause a different Doppler modulation pattern for every point in the sky. So if you have a source that's over here versus a source that's over there, you're going to have to demodulate the signal in different ways. And if you want to search every point in the sky, for instance, you're going to have to demodulate the signal in a different way for every point in the sky. So this quickly becomes a computational challenge. The computational resources you have then, and also the types of questions you want to ask, will help to define the type of search you run when talking about continuous gravitational waves, and in particular when you're searching for gravitational waves from neutron stars. So on our left here, what you see is a pulsar. This is, I believe, the Crab pulsar. And if you know, so for known pulsars, we know their position in the sky, and we also know their frequency and their frequency derivatives. This means that we know exactly where, we know in theory what the gravitational wave signal should look like. We know where it's coming from, so we know the Doppler modulation pattern, and we know the frequency at which to search at. So this means that you can run a relatively cheap search for gravitational wave emission from a particular known pulsar. It's also a very sensitive search. But the problem is at the end of the day, one thing to keep in mind is that at the end of the day, this only tells you about particular pulsars or one particular source. You can also, in the middle here, what I show here is a supernova remnant. So there are some supernova remnants where we know of a compact central object, but we don't detect pulsations from it. So we don't know how fast it's rotating. So because we don't know that, we know where it is in the sky, but we don't know the frequency, for instance. So then you can run what's known as a directed search for continuous gravitational wave emission from a known neutron star, where you know where it is in the sky, so you know what Doppler modulation pattern it has, but you have to search for a wide range of frequencies. And this is sort of a middle case in terms of computational cost as well as search sensitivity. Of course, with these types of searches, at the end of the day, you're still only saying something about an individual source. On the far right here, you can also run an all-sky search. This is where you search basically every point in the sky, or a reasonable subset of the points in the sky to cover the sky enough. And you make some minimal assumptions about what you expect or what you can afford to expect based on about the frequencies and frequency derivatives. This is going to be the most costly search, arguably also the least sensitive search, because you have such a wide parameter space in which you're searching. But at the end of the day, this gives you some understanding about all the sources that are within your grasp, and not just individual ones. So even though it has some drawbacks in a way, it's also very powerful in terms of what the information it gives you in the end. So enough about neutron stars. But if we then turn back and recall that, okay, so bosons around black holes, the bosons annihilate and also produce continuous gravitational waves. So if we already have these search methods to look for long-lived, persistent gravitational waves at well-defined frequencies, if we already have these search methods, why not apply these to boson annihilations or axion annihilations and try to search for that signal to directly look for the existence of the axion or this type of boson? This is going to be a little bit trickier, though. One thing to keep in mind is that when we're talking about neutron stars, when we're talking about continuous waves from neutron stars, we're talking about the fact that each neutron star is emitting a continuous wave at its own frequency, depending on its own, independently of all the other neutron stars in the galaxy or in the universe, right? Because it's just rotating at its own rate. With the bosons, it's going to be a little bit different, of course, because the boson frequency depends on just the mass of the boson itself. So each black hole boson cloud system is going to be emitting roughly the same frequency, or within a small range of frequencies. So this is a slightly different setup, and because of this, we have to make a couple of changes to how we think about our searches and our search results. So to start off with, if we think about the equivalent of a targeted search, so for neutron stars, this was just looking for emission from a particular pulsar, right? So you know where it is in the sky, and you also know the frequency it's at. Of course, this doesn't quite work for the boson annihilation search, because this means not only do you know a black hole or you have a black hole in mind, you also know the boson mass. And this isn't really relevant in this case. The next step up is to run a directed search. So this is the equivalent of running a search on a neutron star for which you don't know the rotation frequency. So here you would use, for instance, a known black hole and an unknown boson mass, which is what we have. We don't know the boson mass. So you could look for gravitational wave emission from a known black hole over a wide range of frequencies, therefore a wide range of boson masses. And this is what is done, for instance, in this EC et al. Paper that I cite here. And good sources for good targets for this type of search are the black holes that are produced at the end of the mergers of binary black holes. So for instance, the black hole that is the end product of 1509-14, which is what they study in this paper, would actually be a good target to look for this type of boson annihilation signal. I'm going to stop this because it's a little distracting. But of course, as a reminder, the rate at which you will build up this cloud, as well as the rate at which you all these processes occur, that's going to depend on, again, this how close in size your black hole and your boson are. And so you really, even though in theory this can search over a large range of boson masses, in reality it's going to be a bit peaked around certain boson masses. So you're still limited around by what you can, you're still limited when you look at a single black hole. So the next step then is to go to an all sky search where we make minimal assumptions on the black hole positions or the boson mass, which is done in this Paloma et al. Paper, and which Andrew was part of. So to do this then, so we already have this machinery to search for continuous gravitational waves from all over the sky. We can actually do a little bit better than just minimal assumptions or no assumptions, because we do know of black holes. Well, we do know the Milky Way houses a certain number of black holes, let's say 10 to the 8 or so is the recent predictions. So if the Milky Way houses 10 to the 8 black holes, we can make some predictions about where they are in the Milky Way, because obviously they're not going to be distributed. They're not distributed uniformly in the Milky Way. You know, some of, there are more of them in the core and fewer of them at the outskirts, that sort of thing. So if we can make a prediction or some simulations on where the black holes are in the Milky Way, as well as how heavy they are and how fast they're spinning and things like that, then we can come up with predictions on what we expect to see for the boson annihilation signal. And this is important because if we detect a signal, find the boson, we win, Nobel Prize, hooray, everything great. But let's be honest here, the chances are greater of detecting no signal. If we don't detect a signal, what does this mean? If we don't detect a signal, is it because the boson doesn't exist, which is always a possibility? Or is it because the black holes that exist don't result in a detectable signal? Maybe the black holes are too old, and so the signals have died off already. Maybe the black holes are too young, and so the signal hasn't had enough time to form yet. Maybe the black holes are all spinning too slowly, and because they're spinning too slowly, either the systems are building up very slowly or they're not forming at all. Maybe the black holes are the wrong mass, and because they're either much lighter or much heavier than the boson really wants to couple with, then maybe these are not going to form detectable signals right now. And so whether or not we can detect the boson annihilation signal for a given boson mass depends not only on the properties of the boson, but also on the properties of the black hole population. And in order to get a handle on how we can interpret null results, we need to get a handle on what we can expect from standard black hole populations, or given some assumptions about the black hole population in the galaxy. So this is what we are doing. This is what we set out to do in our paper. So to start off with, what you're seeing on the right here is a plot that shows how the gravitational wave frequency and the boson mass are related. So the bottom shows the leading order relationship, which basically just says the gravitational wave frequency is twice the boson mass. So if your gravitational wave detectors can detect things between 10 and 2000, let's say, hertz, then the bosons that you're sensitive to are around 10 to the negative 12, 10 to the negative, or 10 to the negative 13, 10 to the negative 12 electron volts. So there's a sort of about two orders of magnitude that we are sensitive to with current gravitational wave interferometers. Of course, there's going to be a few percent all the black holes are going to be to zeroth order emitting gravitational waves at this frequency, but there's going to be a small correction at a level of a couple of percent, depending on how heavy the black hole is, for instance, since the heavier black hole will sort of, you can think of it as it will sort of redshift the emitted frequency slightly. And then also, there's also a smaller correction based on the spin of the black hole. So the first thing we can ask, and I should say also that we in particular in our work have been looking at spin zero particles, so scalar particles, and there's a lot of other works that are looking at vector particles. But if we stick with the spin zero case, the first thing we can ask is, okay, well, are our signals loud enough to be detectable in the first place? So with this prescription, we find that the peak of the gravitational wave strain, so the gravitational wave signal, the loudest it gets is proportional to this alpha value to the seventh power, where alpha is this combination of boson and black hole mass. So we have a set of boson masses that we're sensitive to, and we can also come up with a range of black hole masses that we, from astrophysical arguments, think exist in the galaxy. And this is what you're seeing here on the left. On the left here is a contour plot where the horizontal axis is the boson mass. So this is, again, the same range of masses that we're sensitive to. And on the vertical axis is the black hole mass. So this is going from 5 to 30 solar masses, where this is a reasonable range, we argue is a reasonable range for the masses of black holes in the galaxy. Of course, stellar mass black holes, not counting Sagittarius A star. And for this combination, assuming a distance of 1 kiloparsec or so, then you can get strains from 10 to the negative 21 all the way down to negative 10 to the negative 31. So you can go from being quite detectable to being very loud to being not detectable at all. And you can compare this to what I'm showing on the right, our upper limits from recent all-sky search results. So to be clear, these are, this is a slightly different case. This is searching for, these are upper limits from gravitational waves from neutron stars. So there's one or two slight caveats in here, but you can kind of still roughly take these numbers and compare it to what we expect to get from the boson annihilation signal. So in this case, you can see that even at its most sensitive, we can expect to detect gravitational waves of around 10 to the negative 25 or so in strain. And when you compare this to the plot on the left, you can see that there's a large part of this parameter space of boson and black hole mass where we should be able to detect a signal if it exists, in the sense that the signal should be loud enough. Of course, it's a little bit trickier than this, right? Because what happens is you have a louder signal. Think about the signal as coming from annihilation of particles. Well, then this just means that your particles are annihilating at a faster rate. This also means that your signal timescale will be much shorter. So in this case, while your gravitational wave peak goes as alpha to the 7th power, your gravitational wave timescale goes as alpha to the negative 15. So that when you have signals that are louder, they're going to also decay much more quickly and then quickly become undetectable. There's also another fact that when you have heavier particles, you also require faster spinning black holes. Because remember, there was this requirement that the angular momentum of the boson has to be less than the angular momentum of the black hole in order for it to extract the spin of the black hole and then grow this cloud. And so there's a critical black hole spin above which this cloud can form and below which it can't. And this critical spin increases when you get to heavier and heavier when you get to larger and larger alpha values. So this combination of properties means that it's non-trivial to predict what kind of overall signal we would get from the total set of black holes in the galaxy. So the plot on the left we've just looked at already. This is just showing you contours of signal strength. The plot in the middle is contours of signal duration in years. So how long approximately this gravitational wave will last. This is not quite true. This is just telling you how quickly it decays, but it's roughly can be interpreted in this way. And because this gravitational wave timescale is proportional to alpha to the negative 15, there are parts of this parameter space that have very long timescales. So these signals can last for longer than Hubble time. There are also parts of this parameter space where the signal will disappear within years. And so this is a very wide range to have to take into account. And on the right here, you also, what you have to see here is the critical spin of the black hole that you require in order for the systems to form. Of course, if you have higher or larger critical spins, it becomes harder and harder for the clouds to form around the black holes, just because the requirement for the black holes then is more and more stringent. And so some combinations, for instance, of boson and black hole mass will give you systems that are maybe reasonable to detect in terms of their peak loudness or their peak strain, but these are perhaps, these timescales perhaps are then relatively short and the requirement on the spin of the black holes relatively stringent. And same thing if we look to another part of parameter space. So with all of this combined, this just means that it's difficult to try to interpret the null results from by looking at individual systems. And so what we really need to do is to look at the whole population, the expected signal from the whole population of 10 to the 8 black holes in the galaxy. And so this is what we did. We took a range of boson masses that would produce signals detectable by LIGO and Virgo, for instance. And for each of these boson masses, we convolved this with a set of 10 to the 8 black holes, which I'll discuss in the next slide. And so we have boson masses, black hole masses. We combine this to figure out what is the predicted signal at each of these boson masses or at each of these gravitational wave frequencies. So our prescription for black holes in the galaxy comes from one of some of the co-authors on this paper previously did another study on simulating black holes in the galaxy, and in particular simulating isolated black holes in the galaxy. So in this prescription, we say that the galaxy is the disk plus the bulge in the center plus the halo surrounding, the dark matter halo, let's say. In this prescription, then, black holes are born mostly in the disk and a small percentage as well in the bulge. The ones in the bulge are older than the ones in the disk on average. They're born with an initial velocity because there's a bulk velocity in the disk as well as a random velocity in the bulge. And they also are given natal kicks at birth due to sort of asymmetries in the supernova explosion. And so they're born with an initial velocity, and then they move through the gravitational potential of the galaxy, which is the combination of the potential in the disk, the bulge, and the halo. So they're born at certain times, at certain place, with certain velocities, and then they are they're propagated forward in time to figure out where they are today. So to figure out their positions with respect to the Earth, for instance, today. We also then prescribe we assign each black hole a mass according to a power law distribution. So this is the Saltpeter distribution. This is a distribution that's empirically known to describe fairly well stellar type objects. So with this distribution, we assigned a minimum and a maximum mass. Our main population that we looked about went from 5 solar masses to 20 solar masses, as this is sort of the observed black hole population or observed black hole masses in the galaxy. But of course, especially at the upper end, there's a bit more wiggle room because we haven't observed them. I mean, we've only observed some tens of black holes in the galaxy. Just because we haven't observed them yet doesn't mean that they don't exist at heavier masses. So as another population, we also went to 30 solar masses. Any higher than that, and it starts to become really difficult to form black holes with the properties of the Milky Way galaxy, or at least to form a lot of them, enough of them to matter. We also chose a couple of different spin distributions. For simplicity, we chose these to be uniform distributions. And so our main spin distribution, which is kind of optimistic, is to assume that all spins are between zero, or all black holes are born with spins between 0 and 1, where 1 is just maximally spinning. This is, again, kind of optimistic. So we also had a moderate population of spins between 0 and 0.5, and then a pessimistic population between 0 and 0.3, just to test out the range of different types of populations. So we did this again for every boson mass in our range. For each boson mass, we convolved with 10 to the 8 black holes, a randomized population of 10 to the 8 black holes, according to the prescriptions in the last slide. And for each of these, what we have then is a set of simulated signals. What you're seeing on the plot on the right here is an example of example set of signals for a particular boson. So this is a boson with a mass of 4×10⁻¹³ electron volts. This would produce signals around 193 hertz in the gravitational wave detectors. The vertical axis is the gravitational wave strain, so how loud the signal is. And the horizontal dashed line is the current surge sensitivity. What this means is that, roughly speaking, all the blue dots above the dashed line are detectable, and all the blue dots below the dashed line are not. Zeroth order explanation there. So we did this for a range of boson masses, and here is sort of an example of how different the signals, or what we call the ensemble signals, could be depending on your boson mass. So what you're seeing on the left here, the leftmost plot is the lightest boson mass we searched, which gives signals that are around 100 hertz, 96 hertz. With bosons that are this light, you wouldn't expect to get any detectable signals at all until we get to either more sensitive interferometers or better, more sensitive search techniques. So if you go to really light bosons, you don't see any dots above the horizontal line at all. Then as you get to heavier bosons, you quickly start to build up more and more signals above the search sensitivities. But the search sensitivity is not a single value across the whole frequency range, right? Because the detectors are not similarly sensitive across the whole frequency range. And so this really depends. So this will also set a little bit, will also determine a little bit the number of detectable signals that you have. As well, if you go to, so it's going from, if you compare 4 and 8 times 10 to the negative 13 electron volts, you'll notice that maybe there are more signals at 8, but they're not any louder, right? This is because, remember, as you go to signals that are louder, so heavier combinations of boson here and black hole mass, then those signals also die off faster. So what you're seeing is the fact that if you invoke a heavier boson, as you then produce louder and louder signals, the signals start to die off faster, and then the shape of your population also changes. And then another thing we did that you can do is also look at the properties of the black holes that produce these signals. Like, for instance, if you look at the first two plots on the lower hand, the lower set of plots, these are the black holes in the that produce the signals. So the vertical axis is, again, the gravitational wave strain. The horizontal axis is how far away the black hole is from us. And larger circles mean heavier black holes. So when you have lighter bosons, you need heavier black holes. When you have heavier bosons, you can go to lighter black holes. So overall, I mean, the punchline really is, with all of this meandering and stuff, what are the current detection prospects? How many signals can we expect to see based on our assumptions about the black hole population? And so the main thing we found is, if you take our assumption of black holes being as heavy as 20 solar masses, but being able to spin maximally fast, you can actually get hundreds, almost 1,000 signals in some parts of parameter space. And so these are parts where you might say, if you don't detect a signal here, you could maybe be pretty confident that you probably don't, that the boson probably does not exist at these masses. Of course, there are a lot of caveats here, and one of the main things is, this is a fairly optimistic distribution. If we then go to saying the maximum spin is only 0.5, which is the set of squares in the middle, the number of detectable signals drops by an order of magnitude. And then if you say the maximum spin is only 0.3, so relatively pessimistic, you have barely any detectable signals at all. So the predictions or the interpretations you make on non-detections really depend strongly on what you assume about the black hole spin population, the black hole spin properties in the galaxy. And unfortunately, this is something that we still don't have a very good handle on. Then you could ask, okay, what happens if we invoke the heavier black holes? And it turns out with the heavier black holes, you don't really win that much. You win a bit more at the lightest boson masses. So if you invoke heavier black holes, you can maybe say more, you can be more confident about what you say for the lightest black holes, or at the lightest bosons. But then you lose that advantage, because again, with heavier black holes, you get larger alpha values, you again get signals that decay much more quickly. And so the heavier black holes really only help you at the lower boson masses. And this is sort of the stage that we're at right now. With this paper, we now have a framework for robustly defining these exclusion or at least disfavorment regions of bosons, or axions, if you like. Because what we can do is take this upper limit on gravitational wave strength. How do we get to a range of disfavored boson masses? What we do is then we have to take the expectations on the number of detectable signals and use this middle step in order to try to get to a range of disfavored boson masses based on our black hole population assumptions. Of course, this depends on the assumptions that you make. And so the next step perhaps is to try to do this in a more systematic way, to try to really create this framework in a more systematic way to allow for different black hole population assumptions. And that's it. I'm done.
Great. Thank you, Sylvia. Now, are there any questions for Sylvia?
Andrew, I have one.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Sylvia, for the very clear talk. It was really very nicely presented. Thanks a lot. There's something I thought I had understood almost everything until the end, but your plot with the number of detectable signals then cast some doubts on on my confidence. So what do you actually mean by detectable signal there? So what is it, how do you define a detectable signal? You mean a combination of boson mass and a black hole or what?
So that's a good question. And this really just means that we're speeding through the last part. So my apologies for this because I was looking at the time. What we really mean is for each boson mass, what we do is we simulate the total population, the total set of signals, the ensemble signal from the entire population of black holes. And so this is what you're seeing up here is a set of examples. And then we say, what are the current search sensitivities? So what are the searches currently sensitive to? And this is the horizontal orange lines. And then we count the number of detections above this orange line. And this is really all we're doing, is we're saying for each boson mass, how many of these signals would be above our detectability range? Or sorry, would be above our signal our search sensitivity. This is all we're doing when we're saying, is this how many signals would we detect? Did I explain that or did I make it
worse? Yeah, okay, thanks. Thanks.
Are there any other questions? I have one on these plots too. What is the observation time that you assume?
So we don't assume. Are you talking about the search sensitivity or?
I guess the line, yeah.
Yeah, so the horizontal red lines what do we actually mean when we talk about sensitivity? I think these are, roughly speaking, the 01 search results. I believe what we used was, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, unfortunately, but I believe what we use at the lower frequencies was, I actually don't remember. I should know this. It was the recent search result. So how long was O1? A couple of months?
Like, O1, I think, was something like...
Not longer.
Days of days. I mean, 100, 200 days, something like this.
Okay.
So, something like that. That's fine.
Yeah, it was a couple of months. I should know this. I don't remember this part at all. But this was using, I believe, at the higher frequencies was using the frequency Huff search results that were available at that time. And the lower frequencies was using the Vladimir's Falcon search results that were available at the time.
Okay.
So to be clear, this is slightly outdated now. And the horizontal lines are going to be a little bit lower than they were when we published this paper.
Yeah, got it. And then is there any kind of in these simulations, do you account for the sky position? So if there was a concentration of black holes somewhere, would this be an easier signal to see or does it not really matter?
Yeah, actually so right now in our simulations, we didn't look at that. That didn't matter to us. But that's a good point that if we do an actual search, for instance, there's going to be more to look at than just the number of signals, because we can also look at things like where they are in the sky. Like, for instance, depending on assumptions you make about the black holes in the Magellanic Clouds, those could actually be good sources for a large number of signals because they're fairly close. And in that case, you might see, for instance, if you see a set of signals that are all coming from one of the Magellanic Clouds, then you can be more sure in that case that it could be a signal from the boson annihilation, from boson annihilations, for instance. So yeah, that's something that would a real search would take into account that we haven't done here.
Got it. And then when you simulate the black holes, are you doing it like you actually simulate the dynamics of the black hole that then leads to the boson cloud signal? Is that what you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we really do simulate the dynamics of the black hole. So we have a snapshot in time of 10^8 black holes, where they are in the galaxy, and also which directions they're moving in. And of course, the directions they're moving in is important because that's going to also add another Doppler shift factor to the frequency. And so this is partly what you see in these sets of blue blobs here, is that not, you know, the signal isn't just at a single well-defined frequency, it's spread a little bit. And the spread partly is due to the inherent, you know, black hole mass, for instance, but it's also a large part due to the fact that the black holes are all moving in different directions.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Thank you. Yeah, are there any other questions for Sylvia? Okay, maybe I can ask one more. There is a on slide, I think slide 15, if you go back to there, one of the first ones. Yeah, this one, that one. The grayed out region, what does that mean?
I just flashed this by recently. So this is an all-sky search that was, these are the results, upper limits from an all-sky search done by the Einstein at Home team that was recently put on the archive and recently submitted. The gray points are the ones from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration continuous waves paper, and these are sort of the different points from that paper, the upper limits from the different searches, and then the black points are the ones from the Einstein at Home search, which of course comes out later than the other ones.
Sorry, I think I meant on the left plot.
Makes more sense.
One, like in the top right hand corner.
Yep. The grayed out region here is because of the this is a requirement of the super radiance condition. That's this is the part where it gets a little bit hand waving to me. There are some combinations that are just not allowed by super radiance, and so this is representing that set of combinations. If alpha gets too large, larger than a half or so, if alpha gets too large, then the super radiance just never kicks in. And so that's why that region is grayed out.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, thanks. Okay, any other questions for Sylvia? Okay, I guess not. So thank you, Sylvia, for giving this presentation to us today. Could you send me the slides when you have a chance? And I can, if it's okay, I can forward your email to the people here. If they have any questions for you, they can write to you. Is it okay?
Yep, sure thing.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you. And see you soon in person or something.
Yep. Thanks for having me, and hope everyone has a good rest of the day.
Yeah, okay, bye.
Thanks a lot, Sylvia, also for the nice introduction for non-experts like me.
Yeah, okay, bye.